This is Smart City Dialogue, the podcast of the International Smart City Network, in short, ISCN. I'm Geraldine DeBastian, and it is my pleasure to welcome Simon Höher from Zero360, a Berlin-based innovation company, where Simon is co-lead at the Hybrid City Lab, the public design unit of Zero360. Hi, welcome.
Hi.
Good to have you on our podcast today.
Yes, very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let's begin by having you explain what do you do? What is the Hybrid City Lab and what does Zero360 work on?
Yeah, I'm together with a small team co-leading the Hybrid City Lab. We're the urban and public design studio of Zero360. Zero360 being a strategy firm based in Berlin. About 2.5 years ago, we set out to tackle a specific niche of innovation, which is public innovation. And by that, we mean basically everything that affects specifically the broader public and society. So we work a lot with cities, municipalities, and local governments, but also with civil society actors, like foundations and NGOs. As well as, of course, also companies, wherever they touch upon the fields and the services that basically are in Germany. There's a beautiful word for that, which is Daseinsvorsorge, which basically affect all kinds of public services that really are required for everyone. So this is what we do, and we are working on the strategic end of things. So a lot of the things and the project that we're involved with are looking at some kind of desirable future, which is already the first question of what means desirable and for whom. So a lot of the work actually has to do with futuring and trying to understand different paths of transitions towards a more desirable future for everyone involved. But we also work with organizations to then translate that future into specific projects, prototypes, ideas, and services, digital and analog, to not only remain in the meta discussions, but also make it sometimes a little bit more tangible.
Sounds super interesting and very, very necessary. I think there's this sentiment of bringing more innovation, power, and potential to government, but also to administration and public service providers. And I'm guessing for many, it's still a very new way of thinking. Maybe you can let us in on what kind of experiences you have when you start working with city administration or other relevant stakeholders who might be more used to kind of, let's say, maintaining the status quo or at least not breaking it, rather than thinking about futures and how to achieve them.
It's always it's a challenge, but I think it's also rightfully so a little bit challenging for everyone, especially when it comes to public institutions. There is very valid reasons for these types of organizations being a little bit more inert, maybe sometimes when it comes to new ideas and innovation, in quotes. So I think one thing that really, really helps is to figure out what hinders transformation and change from happening and factor that into any kind of solution that you come up with. We used to call this hidden gains. So it's one of my favorite questions to ask in the beginning of a project is, what do we benefit from not having found the solution yet? Or who benefits from not having found the solution yet? What does the system get from the problem persisting? And usually it's very valid reasons and very valid benefits that come from not having found a solution yet for any given problem. And if you really want to have any kind of project or solution to be a little bit more lasting, it really helps to understand what was the driving or the barring factor from that not happening earlier, and trying to factor that into any kind of solution. That can be things like just feeling more secure, but it can also be very tangible things, as in budgets that are not going into a solution are currently going into some other maybe relevant aspect, and to take that into account when you think about any kind of project. It usually helps. Otherwise, it's a little bit, it's more confrontational that I think it has to be in many cases.
Mm-hmm. And do you, I mean, like, you've been working in the area of social innovation and, let's say redefining things for the better public good for a long time now. Do you feel there is a kind of, you know, shift at the moment happening? Do you see things that you would say, okay, here I can really tell that there's something is changing at the moment?
Yeah, I'd like to say yes. I think there's a shift happening, definitely, that I assume is also happening beyond just my immediate bubble, which is, I think, a shift of awareness of the urgency of change that has to happen. I think this shift in perspective is the first step. There's an interesting formulation of that shift by a, I think, tech philosopher called Danny Hillis, which is, he describes the shift as a shift from the age of enlightenment to the age of entanglements. And I think to try to understand a little bit more what we mean by these entanglements can really help. And what I understand as entanglements is to understand even more how many of the categories that we, but also our public institutions used to work with, are now entangled. That means they are very, very, very hard to disentangle in any kind of projects. Categories being something like public and private, analog and digital, local and global, today and tomorrow, all these kind of things where you usually pick a side and say, well, currently we're doing a digital project, or currently we're looking at public funding. I think it really helps to understand that these clear distinctions don't really work anymore. And I think that this, and not even mentioning, I think, humans and nature and environment, where that distinction really doesn't work anymore. And I think what really is needed for all our institutions is to work with that idea of entanglements, to really work with the fact that for, say, a local community or a municipality, it's not really feasible to only think about their own regional space. You always now also have to think about global implications and how you are affected by that. This can be how Amazon in Germany is, and maybe and probably in many other places, has a very, very strong effect on how our inner cities look like, and how just literally shopping and grocery look like when we go to the city. But it also has to do with, I would say, digital production of the services that we really need in our everyday life. Wikipedia being an example of this. So I think I don't have the answer on how that can be done in like one simple step or even more. But I think the first step is to acknowledge the fact that we now have all to deal with this kind of entanglements. And this is something that we try to explore a little bit more in our work as well, how this shift can take place and how first steps towards this new understanding can be mediated.
One thing that I'm continuously, but currently again thinking about is, where are good cooperation and cutoff points between city administration, between governments, and between citizens, or also private and other stakeholders, in particular when it comes to data gathering and provision. So, you know, you probably also remember that many years ago, everybody was very excited about crowdsourcing initiatives like Fix My Street. And now we are thinking about how to best network machine-to-machine communication without humans ever really interfacing with the data gathering. And within that bandwidth, I think the question of how can citizens and city administrations be partners, and what sort of participation means in these digital contexts, are really still valid and interesting sort of pending question.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think in many cases, it's there's, for valid reason, lacking this kind of one size fits all blueprint on how to deal with this. I think when it comes to data cooperation, but also when it comes to many other places, and it's this very contextual, regional idea of how do we, in the given circumstance, and maybe also the given history, deal with this. I think what, and maybe also already talking a little bit about some of the findings of the study that we did, what I really always find very interesting is when the perspective shifts from designing solutions or projects or any kind of interventions towards designing, I would even say, ecosystems. Mm-hmm. There's another way for this, like the shift from funneling to thinking in portfolios or layering or whatever that is. But the idea behind this remains the same, which is especially looking at these more complex problems, the entanglement problems that I mentioned earlier, the innovation narrative often goes looking for the silver bullet idea that, oh, we had this very, very big challenge of solving sustainable urban mobility, and now we did a design thinking workshop and there's this great idea that we came up with. And I think to not look for this one shot, one silver bullet, but rather look at how can we build an ecosystem or say a framework that allows independent actors, coming back to your questions, corporations, but also civil society actors, public actors, to work in a way that my colleague calls autonomous but aligned. So we have a shared goal, we have a shared idea on what we want to achieve, but since the challenge is multi or manifold, multi-layered, our solutions also have to be. So we have many different ideas in tackling a bigger goal, which again comes back a little bit to, I think, these ideas of mission-oriented approaches that Mariana Mazzucato proposes. I think for me, from the projects also that we looked at in the study and that we also work with in other settings, these, to me personally, are the most promising ones that don't look for the silver bullet, but look for enabling or framing ecosystems to walk towards a shared goal.
Yeah,
which is a little bit more challenging, I would.
More challenging, but it makes a lot of sense, you know, also in light of all the, you know, how much energy is put into creating a pilot, running this one-off project, involving people and getting them all excited, and then the next funding phase doesn't come or whatever. So we all of us who've been working in sort of participation and public sector for a longer time know, you know, from different perspectives, these issues and how more sustainable it is really if you manage to come up with this ecosystem approach or infrastructural approach. All right. But you already mentioned you recently conducted a study for the ICN, a Pathfinder study that highlights different social innovation and participation processes in the context of urban development. So can you give a quick summary of what the study was about and what kind of things you researched and compiled for the study?
Sure. Yeah. We had the chance and the opportunity to look really around the globe to identify interesting, and now comes a long list of words, digital urban social innovation projects. So that means obviously projects that deal with some kind of digital technology in urban settings and address social innovation challenges. And what we did is we really reached out to our network. We did a lot of research ourselves and then really tried to get hold of the people behind the projects. So we ended up with, I think, 10 to 11 projects. Most of them we covered in more detail, but some of them we had like a little bit like a spotlight, just like highlighting this also happens. But what was interesting for me is that we had the chance to talk to many people behind these projects, which is a very valuable, I think, exercise to go beyond the official documentation part. Not necessarily because the official documentation isn't true, just because there's so many things in between the lines, so many little stories or just approaches that to me really just, you really can only understand when you take some time to talk to the people and they walk you through the process. So this is what we did. We compiled this in a long document and tried to frame it also a little bit and structure it into phases of an innovation process, stemming from early on, just ideation phases and prototyping to piloting, to scaling it up and really replicating it even to other regions and other cities. This was a very interesting exercise just because many of the projects shared similar, I think, goals or addressed similar challenges and went through this general process that I just described. But once you take a closer look, obviously, they all become very, very unique in their very specific setting and context, which already, maybe spoiler alert, but I think this is one of the tricky things to navigate whenever it comes to this kind of pathfinders or toolkits or whatever, is to try to mediate any kind of generalizable abstract learnings and blueprints and, oh, this is an interesting general procedure, on the one hand, with very, very unique and contextual situational settings that you can find in any given urban space that kind of makes it different from anywhere else. And to try to work with this is a little bit of a challenging exercise.
I know what you mean. Maybe looking at, you know, the scalability or shareability from a approach or technical angle, did you find any examples of sort of open source approaches to social innovation with the aim of then also being able to share or replicate in other places?
I think many of the projects either were already some kind of replications of something that happened earlier, not necessarily elsewhere, but earlier even in the same setting, but was a follow-up of the previous process. And also many of them put really great effort into trying to tell their story, trying to somehow document it for others to then build upon this. It's not always easy because I think this telling the story, I think we also mentioned this in a previous discussion, this aspect of storytelling, it's an exercise in itself, but we can get to that. To answer the question, I think, open source, as in sharing your work for others to build upon, I would definitely say yes. Not necessarily always open source in the more technical sense of here's the data or here's the resources that we have and for here's available for others to tap into. So I think this differs, but the first part of open sourcing, the conceptual and methodological work that went to it, I would say this holds true for almost all of the projects that we looked at. Everyone was very keen and open to just share what they did and how they went about it.
Great. I find that kind of encouraging to hear, I would say. So you recently presented some of the findings of the study at the online advisory program workshop that we host for the ISCN on a bi-monthly basis, and that video recording is also available in case people would like to see the presentation, and the study is also available, as I understand, in case people want to read up on it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's available on the ICN website. I think it's also available on the social webs. There's a long version of the study, but there's also a little bit of a wrap up of the things that I just mentioned, and also I think some highlights of some of the projects that we looked into.
So I know you already mentioned some of the also key things that you found, and in of course the study, people can read up on all the examples, but maybe just to give a bit more of a teaser, can you name some of the things that maybe even surprised you and your findings, or some of the examples where you thought, oh, this is really cool, people, everybody should know about this one?
Sure. So we were a small team of researchers, we divvied up the work a little bit, but I had the chance, for instance, to talk to the people behind a very interesting project in Helsinki, Finland, called the Agile Pilots Project, which basically tries to address urban innovation projects on a very, I would even say, regular basis. So it's not a one-off project, but it's by now, I would say, even an infrastructure that is in place for a regular program of calls that go out, and of local and even national companies, organizations, and startups to address local challenges in a very dedicated district in Helsinki. I think two districts to be precise. What I found very interesting there the meta learning, like the methodology that they came up with and refined. So by now it really feels like a very mature process of, this is how we usually go about this. This is how we define the challenge. This is how we communicate it to our partners. This is how we make the decision on what solution to implement as a pilot in what specific area. I found it very interesting because it's feeds a little bit into what we said earlier about not trying to have this one-off project, but make it more of an ongoing, recurring exercise to keep learning. For me, that was one of the interesting parts, because it also really goes into building that ecosystem system up with all kinds of actors and partners being involved. I found that very interesting. Another project that I really liked was the project around improving air quality in Krakow, Poland. There, the idea was to draft a regulatory document for an air quality program. And this, I think, rather conceptual process of drafting regulation, it was backed up by a very hands-on innovation process to say, okay, in addition to us trying to improve regulation for air pollution in the area, let's also think about how we can use and already build little prototypes and ideas and projects that would also tackle the problem from another angle. So both processes of designing a solution on a technical end, and also thinking about what should the regulatory scope for us be to achieve this goal, they kind of went hand in hand. And I found this quite interesting, how the regulatory public policymaking process was interlinked with a more bottom-up innovation technical process on the other hand. And also for most of these projects, one big challenge, obviously, because they were fairly recent, was the pandemic. And I think in Krakow, but also in many other places, how they dealt with the fact that all the initial projects plans didn't really go through because people couldn't just meet in person anymore, how they dealt with this, how they built up this internal resilience. Also, they also just acknowledge, well, things were very hard. It's very hard to coordinate decentralized projects with many different stakeholders without even having the chance to meet in one room over a couple of years. It's, even though you can tell a nice story afterwards, it's just a challenging exercise. I also found that interesting to see how people dealt with it, how they came up with solutions. And I think the very well-known solution for cities project by the GIZ itself can show that it doesn't only has to be like this resilience in terms of reacting to the challenges, but there are also projects that can respond to a crisis like the corona pandemic by even launching a project to say, what did others do in response to that crisis and how can we replicate the findings to another area? So we also looked at that one, the solution for cities context, where we obviously had the closest of links and opportunities to talk to the people behind the project, which I also find very, very inspiring to see how this is still growing, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, especially looking back, so the beginning of the pandemic and this huge effort to just share resources and make knowledge available and so many initiatives coming up, it's good to see what, you know, 2 years later is still around from that first phase, perhaps, of motivation in that direction and also still taking effect. And some of the things that have, you know, changed in terms of understanding who are critical providers of infrastructure. And again, this idea of partnership between citizens and governments also in the COVID context.
Yeah. Maybe just another comment on this. I think it also can, and one of the learnings, maybe we can talk about what other things we learned, but one of the things that stood out to me, which I found quite interesting, someone really said this very openly, in the beginning of the project or of any given project, just be really, frankly, super opportunistic in terms of what works. If there's a challenge and a crisis, which is always the case, I would say, just go with either where a program or a budget is, which in some of the cases were. So how can we fit into an existing budget that is there and make this also provide value to whoever is behind this? How can we identify the people that are just very open to work with us and are also motivated? So I think especially in the beginning of the project, it turned out that in many cases, it really helps to just go like wherever there was the easiest movement to proceed, it in many cases turned out to be very worthwhile to pursue that path. It means that in some cases you have to adopt or even reframe a little bit what you're doing, but it also means that you can progress. And if you keep in mind and inside what you originally set out to do, it allows you also to be flexible on many other aspects.
I think that's a good takeaway for everyone. Yeah.
Yeah. I think this kind of deliberate opportunistic approach to some of these challenges can also sometimes help.
Should maybe be an approach to general life, yeah. Everyday life.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to highlight before we, come to an end of our conversation?
We tapped upon this earlier when I mentioned the storytelling aspect. I think really innovation is, in many, many cases, it's a story. I think even the methodology and the process of there's a challenge, then there's an ideation process, then there's a solution, then there's implementation of the solution. It helps to orientate yourself as to where you are in a given process. But I think it also really, really helps to keep in mind that many of these stories about successful projects are really, you can only tell them in hindsight in many cases. And you can only connect the dots of, oh, this was actually the solution to that problem. And this is how we scaled it up. You can only, in many cases, do that in hindsight as well. It doesn't mean, I would say, to not aim for these kind of things, but it also, I think, helps to take many of these success stories with a grain of salt, because they are usually told after the fact. And it's one of the tricky things, I think, with these kind of challenging or wicked problems, but to keep in mind that the narrative and the story that you tell about a project is as much part, I think, in many cases, of the documentation and the project itself. It's just something that helps with sharing your own story, but also with taking some of the learnings that you take from others as well, with this kind of contextual awareness. There are many, many, many things usually left out. There are maybe some clear connections and ideas added in afterwards, which is not necessarily bad. It just means that I think we as humans, we work in stories And it's not necessarily always how the world and complex projects go. It's not this clear linear path of challenge, problem, solution, and done. It's way more messy, and it's a selection work to choose which path to tell about and which mm-hmm. path to leave out.
And I think it's a really interesting thought, because it means to also think about how are you going to document, who's going to be involved in documentation. So who gets to tell that story, perhaps also from different perspectives in hindsight. And also, I think it's a good reminder not just to rush in from one to the next. And I think that's something we experience in our everyday work life as well, to really take time when you finish a project, sit down with your team, reflect, and that's a really important part of the process before you just jump into the next thing.
Yeah. That would be such an interesting research work, to not look at, I don't know, 10, 12 different projects, but to look at one project from 10 different viewpoints.
Yeah.
And keep looking at the same story from many different actors involved, how it felt for them, how it came to be for them, things they didn't know, I did know, looking for the blind spots. Maybe that's an interesting follow-up one.
Very nice. Maybe as an inspirational closing sentiment, but it's been really insightful. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. And I would encourage everybody who's listened to this podcast to go and read the Pathfinder study. And of course, check out Zero360 and your work in case they want to learn more and be in touch.
Thank you very much. Yeah, looking forward.
Also looking forward to more conversations soon. And hope everybody who's listened to this has a great day or evening, depending on where you're listening from. Bye-bye. Hello.